Most of you who are acquainted with technology, you know what terms of service are. If you sign up for Facebook, for example, you'll be required to put in a username and password, and then you'll get a contract full of pages and pages of fine print that you are supposed to read and sign before you are allowed to use their site, and most people probably don't. But you've got to do it before you sign up for software programs like Microsoft Office and social media apps like Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and other technology. If you're purchasing a paid app, you may be agreeing to what your payments will be on a monthly basis. And if you're purchasing a free app, you are probably agreeing to the release of your information to the advertising and marketing companies where social media apps really make their money. Kind of funny, I hear people complain about, well, they're selling our information. You agreed to it when you signed up. And they probably are selling their your information. Yes, that's how they make money. But there is a cost to using those services. There is a responsibility on the provider's part. There's a responsibility on your part, whether you read the fine print or not. Well, may I suggest to you that whenever we pick up a phone, a computer, or an iPad, that there is definitely more of a cost than just exposing personal information or losing out on some money. The terms of service for social media are far greater than we might realize. So we want to spend some time critically thinking about this from a Christian perspective today. And so we're just going to go about this by just kind of asking four questions, and then I'm going to give my answers, and I'd be interested in your answers too, as we can continue this conversation after services. But the first question that I had is, why do you think that we check our phones so much? Why do you think we check our phones so much? And I'm going to give some of the answers that are found in this book. This book was kind of the inspiration for this lesson in some ways. There's not a lot of scripture in this book, so I've added a lot of scripture. But this is written by Chris Martin, who's a believer, and his book is titled Terms of Service, The Real Cost of Social Media. But he mentions two reasons in his book why we check our phones. He says, after all these years and plenty of cautionary tales about the negative effects of the social internet, that's what he calls it, we all continue to log on. Why? What makes Americans check their phones 96 times per day? That's the average amount of times Americans check their phones every day, which is once every 10 minutes. I'm sure you've seen this, right? I mean, anytime I go into a store now, I find somebody hiding out in an aisle and they're pulling out their phone, and you go to a fast food restaurant, they're hiding out in the back room, they're checking their phone. I'm sure that you and your workplaces, you deal with this with people who are on their phones and they're not working. But he mentions two primary factors keep us coming back to the social internet. One is the fear of missing out. Second, addiction. We're addicted. And so I want to take a look at a couple of verses with you. Do you realize the first sin was in part inspired by FOMO, right? The fear of missing out. Genesis chapter 3, 1 through 6. It says, the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, has God indeed said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden? The woman said, we may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God said, you shall not eat it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die. And the serpent said, you will not surely die. God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. You are missing out. That's kind of the argument. So Eve buys into that hook, line, and sinker that she's missing out. And when she saw that the tree was good for food, pleasant to the eyes, a tree desirable to make one wise, you got to be part of this if you want to be considered wise. She took of its fruit and ate. She gave to her husband with her, and he ate. I think you can make the argument that Eve acted because Satan made her think she was missing out. Kind of sad. She could eat mangoes, bananas, apples, pomegranates, peaches, plums, oranges, cherries, kiwis, coconuts, lemons, limes, pears, papayas. But she just had to have that one thing or she was missing out. Satan made her think that. Sometimes we've been made to think that. If you're not on Facebook, you are really missing out. Did you see this story? Did you see what this person posted? You're really missing out if you're not there. If you're not seeing my post on Instagram, you're really missing out. TikTok is the newest rage. If you're not on TikTok, well, you're just like with the old people on Facebook, and you are missing out. If you don't have Snapchat like the other teams, well, you're missing out. You got to get Snapchat too. If you don't follow this athlete, this influencer, this celebrity, you're missing out. We are led to believe, like Eve, that if we're not checking every social media platform and every update and every notification, we're missing something. So what does that lead to? When you think you've got to be on every new social media app that comes on the scene, what it leads to is addiction, because there's a lot of them and they're time consuming and they suck up our time and our energy. And so it leads to addiction. Well, 1 Corinthians 6:12 says, all things are lawful for me. I'm not arguing that social media apps are unlawful. They are lawful, but that doesn't mean that they're helpful. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be brought under the power of any. Sometimes we are addicted. So Christians need to be careful of being so addicted to any fleshly thing that it's going to lead to neglect in spiritual things. And we cannot argue that a communication medium like social media is unlawful or sinful in and of itself. It's just a form of communication. Newspaper is a form of communication. It can be used to communicate bad things. It can be used to communicate good things. So the medium itself is not sinful. That's going too far, but we can argue it's sinful when it becomes an addiction. So two reasons we check our phones so much, FOMO and addiction. Well, second question that we want to get to is, well, what are some negative effects of our social media addiction? What are some of the negative things that are coming out as a result of this addiction? Well, Chris Martin again says this in his book, the social internet is designed with addiction in mind. You do have to realize that. The people who are programming these things, they want you to be addicted. They purposely include algorithms that appeal to your emotions, whether that be anger or whether that be things that make you laugh, because they want you to stay online. The longer you stay online, the longer that you get to see the advertisers who are paying for advertisements online. So the more you're on, the more they're making money. So that is how they design it. The people who create the social media apps and websites, they want you to become enslaved to these platforms. The broader social internet and the various social media platforms within it are probably best understood as a drug dealer dispensing a variety of narcotics. Sometimes the content makes us feel great. Sometimes it makes us feel inadequate. Sometimes it energizes us, and sometimes it depresses us. But just like drugs that have their different effects, social media has those kind of effects on us as well. And these are some of the results, the consequences. Well, is this why is this addiction harmful? Well, I'm going to give you a few reasons. We're so afraid of missing out what's online that we're missing out on life offline. Okay? We're not enjoying creation, and God created this amazing world for us to enjoy as an evidence of Him. We're not exercising as much, and so we are more out of shape, perhaps, than we've ever been. I hear this from older people, especially, that when they were young, they remember seeing kids out on the ball fields and on the basketball courts just playing and running around the neighborhood. And you don't see that kind of stuff anymore because they're playing, but it's sitting and doing nothing but staring at a screen. They're on their video games, and they're inside, and they're on their phones. So they're not exercising as much. We're not spending as much real time with family because we're spending time on our phones. And so we're not communicating, enjoying our family like we should. And we're not as involved in our communities. It's really hard to get people involved in your communities, on your various boards. And it's hard if you talk to people who run sports leagues. It's hard to get parents to coach teams and to volunteer to help. at the schools. It's hard to find volunteers who are willing to help. Maybe some of that has to do with the fact that we're spending so much time online, we're not as involved offline. Some are addicted for sinful reasons. So addiction is harmful when we are addicted for sinful reasons. Sometimes we really enjoy the polarizing arguments and the chance to fight and argue with people. Sometimes we're addicted because we like controversy. Have you ever been that person who said, did you see what this person wrote? Did you see the comments where they were arguing with one another? What does that say? You like the controversy. You're feeding off of that. Sometimes we like to gossip about what we've seen. Did you see this picture that was posted? Instead of talking to the person who posted the picture, we talk to other people about the picture. That's gossip. And if that's why you're online, just so you got something to talk about, that's wrong. Sometimes we look at things that we shouldn't, so we're addicted because of lust. And obviously, pornography would be a whole another lesson. There's pornography that's obviously you're not supposed to have on social media, but there's obviously a lot of immodesty to look at there. Sometimes we're addicted because we're addicted to self-promotion. We're addicted to the likes. We feed off of that. We're addicted to the followers. 1 Peter 4:15. Take a look at a couple passages here and just think about this with regard to your social media usage. 1 Peter 4:15 says, "Let none of you suffer as a murderer, a thief, an evildoer," but this last phrase is the one that's pertaining to social media, "or as a busybody in other people's matters." We may just waste a lot of time just being involved in other people's business. Sure, they put it out there for us to see. That doesn't mean that we need to spend all of our time looking at it, though, any more than I need to be peeping in all of my neighbor's backyards just because I can see it. Don't be a busybody in other people's matters. Titus chapter 3 and verse 10. Titus chapter 3 and verse 10. Notice a warning flag that Paul delivers to Titus. "Reject a divisive man after the first and second admonition." So people who use this medium in order to be divisive and argumentative, this passage says you should avoid those types of people and those types of arguments. Verse 9 says, "Avoid foolish disputes and genealogies and contentions and strivings about the law. They are unprofitable and useless." Sometimes we can really involve ourselves in things that are not profitable, and that the Bible actually says we should be avoiding those types of arguments. We also may be feeding our souls a spiritually sickening diet. Just because somebody says it on social media doesn't mean it is worth your time. Social media gives every fool a following. Okay, there's just some athletes, I don't really care what you think about politics, and I'm not going to even waste my time reading what you have to say. You know, and I don't care what somebody who's a Hollywood celebrity thinks about religion. What? Because you can act in front of a camera, that makes you an expert on religious topics? I don't care what you have to say. And yet we feed ourselves and we get some of our information and we develop our belief systems on by following people who really we should just not be listening to. People who pretend to be religious online as well, but they don't really know the Bible. They're just spouting their opinions about religious things. Matthew 7 and verse 15, Jesus says this in verse 15, "Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravenous wolves." Well, they're on the internet too. They're on your social media forums. They're on Twitter. 1 Corinthians 15:33 says, "Evil companions or evil communication corrupts good morals." You can be corrupted by what you're reading and what you're seeing, especially if all the stuff you're following is people who are godless, who are not spiritually minded. There might be some people that we need to stop following, that need to be cut off of our friends list if they're having a negative influence on our faith, because it will corrupt your good morals. Instead, Philippians 4 and verse 8 says that our focus in our meditation as Christians, verse 8 says, "Brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, and just and pure and lovely and of good report. If there is any virtue in anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. Now, there are people who are using social media for good, who are posting positive things and true things and virtuous things and pure things. And by all means, follow those people and learn from them and be encouraged by them. But you need to be careful who you're learning from. Who's feeding your mind, and who's feeding your heart, and who's feeding your soul? You know, G-I-G-O is the old, this whole sermon just full of all kinds of acronyms, right? Garbage in, garbage out, right? G-I-G-O. You let the garbage in, then it's going to come out in your life. Once it comes into your heart, it's going to come out in some way. The other problem, another problem with social media and the addiction is it sucks us into comparison culture. We compare our lives, the lives of people that we see online. And that's a dangerous thing because their life and what other people are capable of doing with the situation that they're in would be very different than the situation that you're in. We've got some friends who have been blessed enough financially that they've been able to work remote and they travel the world. They're in Portugal. I think right now they're in Portugal, actually. But they're in Portugal 1 minute. They've got a home on the in Utah. They've traveled to Thailand. They're 10 years younger, and it's easy to think, man, I wish that could be me. That looks pretty fun. I'd like to just travel the world and just work 3 hours on my computer. And that's not reality for most people. And so quit comparing yourself to those unique situations. But sometimes that makes us kind of depressed. You know, you compare yourself to this woman who always posts about how awesome her husband is, who's Mr. Physically Fit. He's always so kind. He's bringing gifts to her. He's taking her on lavish vacation. You think, my husband really stinks. You know, and we can start comparing and vice versa. We can start comparing ourselves. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, we can do the same thing with churches, by the way, too, and with preachers and things like that. And that's not good. You be content with the family that you have. Be content with the city you live in, with the church situation that you're in. Be content. The Bible encourages contentment, not comparison. 2 Corinthians 10 verse 12 says, we dare not class ourselves or compare ourselves with those who commend themselves. They, measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves, are not wise. And so we need to be careful about comparing ourselves, being content with what we have in our situation and the ways in which God has blessed us. Well, one more thing about the addiction that makes it harmful is our addiction to positive attention can result in creating a hypocritical, superficial online persona that is far from reality. In Matthew 6, Jesus condemns some of the Pharisees because they like to sound a trumpet about how righteous they were in their giving, and they like to pray these very eloquent, long prayers to impress people on the outside, but if you read about what Jesus says about those Pharisees over and over again, he says, really, they were hypocrites, though. That was just the persona they wanted people to see, that they wanted to create. It wasn't really who they were. And we need to be careful of that, because we can create an image for other people to see online that isn't really true and consistent with reality. That's just sometimes the nature of it. It gives people a false view of reality and what the real situation is. You know, nobody takes a picture of their house when there's, you know, puke and dirty diapers laying around and toys laying everywhere. And after they've woken up out of bed and the lipstick is smeared and their hair is all, nobody does that, do they? But if you've raised three kids that were little, and sometimes that is the reality. You can post the makeup and the pictures, and we're just one big happy family, and we never smile, and we never argue, and everything is wonderful, and you can play pretend all you want, but we all know good and well that's just not how it always is, okay? And so sometimes we can start to think that's the way it must be, you know? We must not be doing it right. Sometimes people are giving you a false sense of reality. So that addiction can be harmful when that starts to happen. Well, third question, this. In what ways has social media shaped our thinking? Because the way that we think is important as Christians. We need to think spiritually, we need to think biblically, and sometimes social media has impacted the way that we think. So I got four things for you here that is from, which I think is the best part of actually Chris Martin's book here, Terms of Service, if it's something that you want to read. I'm just kind of giving you the Cliff Notes version. But he gives you four things in this book. He says, one of the problems with how this has affected our thinking is we now believe that if something gets attention, then it must have value. So this social media has forced us to believe, we believe attention assigns value. So he says this on page 63 and 64, we have come to believe if it is trending, it is important. And we ought to give it our attention, no matter how insignificant or downright foolish it may seem. And likewise, we have come to believe that how much attention we receive is an accurate measure of how important or valuable we are. We take pride in our followers, the number of likes we receive, and how many people retweet our ideas. And so we believe that attention assigns value. Does that make sense? But you know what? Not everything that receives a whole lot of attention is necessarily valuable. I'll give you a very simple example just in my own life. Right? If I post a picture of my dog playing in the snow, I might get 200 people that like that. If I post a Bible verse, maybe 10. Just because 200 people liked my dog doesn't mean my dog is more important than the Bible. Sometimes it just may mean people have a messed up value system. Right? Tells us a little bit about our culture that we live in. Just because you get a lot of attention, just because Will Smith slapping Chris Rock at an award show got a lot of attention doesn't really mean it was really good for us to think about and spend an entire week arguing about and talking about. Just because it gets a lot of attention doesn't mean it has a lot of value. Just because it's trending, just because the video went viral doesn't mean it's good for you. So we believe, though, if you got a lot of likes, a lot of followers, and it gets a lot of attention, that it must be good. Here's what Matthew 7 says. This is Jesus. Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide, and the way is easy that leads to destruction. And those who enter by it are many. The gate is narrow, though. The way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. Sometimes the idea, the thought, the philosophy that gets a lot of attention isn't necessarily the right way. You've got to be willing to do what's right, even if there are few who endorse it or like it or approve of it. The second thing he notes, that in the way in which this has changed our thinking, is we seek affirmations above truth. He goes on to write, he says, people love to consume and share content that supports their belief systems, regardless of whether that content has any basis in fact. Wanting to pursue comfort or affirmation at the cost of truth has never been easier. Social media has created an environment in which everyone is a reporter, and the news can be whatever you want it to be. So for my Christian readers, who else should be more interested in pursuing the truth than us? Sometimes we seek affirmations above truth. In this chapter, the author talks about how so many conspiracy theories are basically just rumors that support what we want to believe about politics and about politicians and about celebrities and about hot issues. So he makes the point, be careful that you're not just sharing a conspiracy theory because it supports what you want to believe about a certain issue or politician or topic. Make sure that it's the truth before you would share it and endorse it for others to see, because we're people of truth, right? We need to be careful we're not sharing quotes or memes just because they affirm what we want to believe, and make sure they are true. I've seen a lot of Christians from all over the place, and they'll quote somebody or some saying that somebody had, but it's not biblical. Sometimes it's anti-biblical. You shouldn't be sharing that if you're a Christian. You be very careful that what you're quoting aligns with the biblical worldview and belief system before you share it. We've got to be careful we're not sharing stories that are based on rumors or hearsay because they support our side and make sure they are true. We can do that sometimes, even with media stories. And we need to be careful that we're not quoting from and citing stories and articles just because they make an argument we agree with and make sure that they are true. Sometimes we're just simply posting things because it fits what we want to believe, not because it's true. So be careful. Proverbs 27 verse 5 says this, "Open rebuke is better than love carefully concealed. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. The kisses of an enemy are deceitful." Sometimes we would rather hear somebody pat us on the back and affirm who we are and what we believe than we want to hear truth. But this passage says truth is better for you to hear than just someone who's going to flatter you. So appreciate the people who tell you the truth. Share the truth with you, not just the people who want to flatter you just so you can stay their friend. Now, the third thing, and here's where we start getting into what we're seeing take place, I believe, heavily in our culture. And it's a scary thing for Christians and for preachers like me. Because what we're beginning to see in terms of our thinking is that social media has caused us to demonize people that we dislike. And it's very easy to do that over social media. He goes on to write in this chapter, he says, "If a generation of young people, the people who spend the most time engaging on the social internet, has been raised to believe that people who disagree with them are potentially harming them, they will grow to believe it is their moral responsibility to silence any disagreement and remove dissenters from public discourse. And this has led to the proliferation of cancel culture." Right? Familiar with that term, cancel culture? Where does cancel culture come from? Well, where it comes from is if we don't like what someone believes or says, or if they have corrected or tried to correct our thinking in some way, our response sometimes to that is not, you know, humility and, you know, "I'm sorry, you're right, I was wrong," an apology. Sometimes it's that you disagreed with me, you publicly argued with me, you pointed out that I was sharing a falsehood, I'm going to demonize you because I don't like you, because you hurt my feelings. You stepped on my toes. We demonize people that we dislike and we want to remove them from the public conversation. This happened in the scriptures, right? People didn't like what John the Baptist was saying and preaching. He was stepping on their toes. They didn't like what Jesus was saying, that he was exposing some of the hypocrisy of this chief priest, scribes, and Pharisees, and religious people even. And so what did they do to John the Baptist and Jesus? Well, Jesus says, "John the Baptist did not come eating or bread or drinking wine. You said he has a demon." So we call him names. We try to make people think that John the Baptist is actually evil when he's good. "The Son of Man has come eating and drinking. You say, look, he's a glutton and a wine bibber, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Wisdom, though, is justified by all her children." And so Jesus points out this is what people were doing when he was around. This is still what people are doing. And sometimes they're doing it to Christians. "You speak out against sin, you rebuke immorality, and you will be demonized on social media." We demonize people we dislike. I know preachers, I have friends who are preachers, who have literally had their Facebook pages taken away and removed, and their social media pages, depending on the format that they're on, because there was somebody that reported them who didn't like what they were preaching and what they were teaching and what they were standing for, and so they were cut off. We demonize people we dislike. And we try to get them in trouble. What else do with people we demonize? We want to destroy them. We want to destroy people we demonize. Now, there's a few quotes here that he gives, and so this is going to be kind of the longest section of quotes, but he gets more into why do we have cancel culture? So he goes on to say this on page 128, 129 in his book, Terms of Service. "The offended will often stop at nothing to dismantle the life of the offender in the name of justice and accountability." We talked about justice a couple months ago. Well, what he's saying here is connected to what we were talking about in those lessons, that we need to understand the difference between biblical justice and what our world is calling justice, because our world is calling cancel culture justice. That's what you deserve. You said something that hurt my feelings. You rebuked me. You stood up against my lifestyle. And so justice demands we shut you up and we shut you down if you're on social media. And so we're doing this and we're putting biblical words and attaching biblical words to it to make it sound like we're doing a good thing. Now, in the end, the goal is to silence, it's to humiliate, it is to cancel the offender as a form of justice for the offended. And this series of events has been repeated so often that an entire culture has been formed around its existence. We will call it cancel culture. He goes on. He says, the Me Too movement, you guys are familiar with that from a few years ago, is undoubtedly the crown jewel of cancel culture. Major Hollywood figures, politicians, religious figures, and others in positions of power are rightly called out. You know, sometimes cancel culture gets it right. Okay, so sometimes what you're standing against, if it's sexual abuse and pedophiles and things like that, sometimes you're right to speak out against that. I'm not saying that sometimes they don't get it right. And Me Too movement, in some situations, they were getting that right. Guys like Harvey Weinstein, that guy needed to be called out. He was dirty. He was bad. He was evil. He needed to be called out. And so often on social media, they're called out for their sexual malpractice in the recent or distant past and rightly removed from their positions of power. But he goes on to say, not all of cancel culture, though, is a response to a real injustice like the Me Too movement. Instead, people begin to conflate holding the powerful accountable for their oppression and abuse and dismantling the lives of people who hurt my feelings or disagree with me. And what results is a sloppy form of mob justice that helps no one and serves to perpetuate outrage. In other words, sometimes people have gotten it right, sometimes they get it wrong. And what they think they are standing against, actually God would stand for. Cancel culture, and he gives some reasons why. Cancel culture leads to more negative consequences than positive results. Here are four primary factors. Subjective morality. And we talked about truth a few months ago, right? When you don't have a biblical standard for truth, right and wrong, and your sense of morality is subjective, then sometimes what you stand against is not going to be something that God would stand against. And so because of subjective morality, cancel culture gets it wrong sometimes. The other problem with cancel culture is there's no incentive for reconciliation. They want to cancel you. They want to shut you down. They don't want to be friends with you and make things right with you. They don't really care if you apologize. You did something wrong and you committed an unforgivable sin and you're done. That's not biblical. Sometimes there's unclear objectives and demands. Okay, so you think someone did something that was wrong, that was offensive. So what do you expect to accomplish by rallying thousands of people and getting them to share your, you know, vindictive acts of, you know, outrage and words of vengeance against them? What do you want to accomplish with this? What's the end goal? And sometimes there's not a very clear end goal. We just want to embarrass somebody. And fourthly, there's no realistic means of follow-up. Once you've got them canceled, then how do you make things right? How do you follow up with that and actually make positive progress? And so he says the other reasons people are canceled on the internet aren't always so cut and dried as Me Too type stuff. Some adults are canceled for tweets they sent when they were in their teens. You know, you've seen that with Supreme Court justices that have been, you know, people will pull out calendars that they had when they were in high school, and here they are 30 years later, and they've grown up, and they wouldn't say some of those things that they say, and we bring that up to try to humiliate and to embarrass. What's the end goal? It's just to humiliate you. I know you're not like that anymore, that you're not doing that stuff anymore, but sometimes we bring stuff up. I hope everybody in here is mature enough to, when you hear that about something that somebody did when they were in middle school, that you're not going to keep bringing that up to them. I think we all did some and said some dumb things when we were in middle school and high school, didn't we? I hope I'm not the only one. But sometimes we'll do that, just we want to embarrass somebody. And that's part of cancel culture today. Others are being canceled for holding a biblical or traditional sexual ethic. If you oppose homosexuality or transgenderism or any other type of immorality, well, you should get canceled in the eyes of some. You should be shut down. Others are canceled for offenses that may have been unintentional or ambiguous. You just kind of didn't realize you were saying something that was offensive to someone. So it starts to get kind of hairy. Did you know that Jesus was a victim of cancel culture? And as people who are trying to live for righteousness, sometimes we will be persecuted and be victims of that as well. Well, Matthew 27 says the chief priests and elders persuaded the multitudes that they should ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. If you want to see an example of mob justice and what it looks like, it looks like the people who were attacking Jesus before he went to the cross. That's what it looks like. The governor answered and said to them, "Which of the two do you want me to release to you?" They said, "Barabbas." Pilate said, "What then shall I do with Jesus, who is called Christ?" They said, "Let him be crucified." And the governor said, "What evil has he done?" They cried out all the more, saying, "Let him be crucified." They didn't even have a really good argument to make. It was just that we don't like him. He offends us. And the mob just cries out, "Let him be crucified. Let him die." Sometimes the mob gets it wrong. Sometimes we demand that the people who are actually innocent and who are approved by God and standing for God, sometimes we demand that they are the ones who suffer when the ones who are guilty get released. The situation is really no different today, other than no one's perfect like Jesus was. But sometimes you get canceled for just doing the right thing. Here's the other thing that bugs me about cancel culture, and that is, if you're a Christian, you have to be willing to forgive and give people the opportunity to make things right. And I don't see that in cancel culture. It's that you've sinned and you've done something wrong that violates us in some way, and so it's just, we're done with you. We want to destroy your influence. We want to humiliate you. And we don't want to give you the chance to make it right. Christians give one another the chance to make it right. In Luke 17 and verse 3, it says, "Take heed to yourselves. If your brother sins against you, rebuke him. If he repents, forgive him. And if he sins against you seven times in a day, and seven times in a day returns to you saying, 'I repent,' you shall forgive him." There has to be room for forgiveness and grace in how Christians operate against wrongdoers. Cancel culture doesn't give that opportunity. Well, last question that was on your sheet there was this. What do we need to change then to help break this habit? What are some ways that we can help change some of the negative ways that the social media is causing us to act out and think? Well, I'll just give you a few suggestions that were in this book. I would probably offer a lot more if this was a different sermon, but I'm just kind of outlining a few things that are said here and putting Bible verses along with it. But some things that I would encourage is enjoy God's creation. When you see social media, you're seeing things visually with your eyes. You're reading things. But God has a creation that we can enjoy, that where we can smell and we can taste and we can touch and we can enjoy and we can feel. And I think God wanted us to use all of those senses to enjoy what he's given us in his creation. So get out there and go climb a mountain and go hike somewhere. And go climb a tree with your kids and play some disc golf with some people from church and go out to the concert under the trees and listen to some bluegrass and enjoy life and get out of your houses and away from your phones and disconnect sometimes. God's creation is there for us to enjoy, and we need to make some time to enjoy it. We're spending too much time in front of our screens. I would also say this, listen before you post out of anger, because sometimes we're posting so quickly because we're angry and somebody's upset us and it's made us mad. I mean, it's like you see some people typing, you can almost hear them typing, you know? James 1:21 says, be swift to hear, slow to speak. Don't instantly respond every time somebody ticks you off. Sometimes think, sometimes listen. They might be making a decent argument that you need to listen to. Be slightly open-minded to listen before you respond out of wrath and out of anger. But be very careful that you do not post out of anger. I'll tell you, it's a lot easier to say things over your phone and over your computer than it is face-to-face. So maybe think about, there's something there that's offended me and that's bothered me, especially if it's a brother in Christ, but I need to have a face-to-face conversation with them so that I don't say something that I wouldn't normally say because I'm saying it in a temper. And without them understanding my inflection and my tone and how I need to say it. So listen before you post out of anger. Speak wisely. The people that you invite to church, sometimes over social media, hopefully, well, these might be the same people that are reading your other posts and the other things that you say and the other things that you type and the other things that you write. And if you're saying things that are offensive and tactless and rude and demeaning, it may make them a little harder to accept your invitation to come worship with you and study the Bible with you when they're seeing inconsistency with how you act online. Colossians 4 and verse 6 gives this advice. Walk in wisdom, verse 5, walk in wisdom toward those who are outside, redeeming the time. Use your time wisely. And verse 6, let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. There's been some times where I've typed something out, I was upset about something, but I kind of have a rule for myself that especially if it's an email or something like that, I'm going to sit on this overnight before I send this, because I may be typing something out of anger or too quickly, and I might be too rash with my response, and I need to think about it. And there's been a lot of letters and emails and texts that I've deleted the next morning because I wasn't in the right frame of mind. And there's been a couple that I've sent regretfully that I wish I hadn't. Give yourself time to think and speak wisely and speak with grace. And season your conversation with salt. Show humility. Sometimes we're wrong. It might actually do good if sometimes when you did post something that was wrong or that was an error or it was insulting, if you just admitted when someone says something to you about that, if you could just say, you know what, you're right. That was disrespectful. And that was rude. And I probably should just go ahead and delete that. It says something about you when you could admit, I'm wrong. Shows humility. So show some humility every once in a while. And just be willing to admit, I pushed something I shouldn't have pushed, and I did something that I shouldn't have done, and said something that I shouldn't have said. So I'm going to admit that I'm wrong. Assume the best about other people and be willing to forgive other people. We all make mistakes in judgment sometimes, and we need forgiveness from others. But then, finally, discipline and limit your online time. So, discipline. Ephesians 5, redeem the time. Be disciplined with your time. You can set screen, you can set social media settings on your phone, which kind of boot you off after so many minutes or hours of the day. Use those settings if you find yourself online too much. And limit your online time. Let other people also hold you accountable. Find somebody who's a friend or a brother or sister in Christ who you trust their judgment. And every once in a while, when they see something that you've posted or you said, and they say, you know what, I'm not sure you should have said that, especially if the elders come to you and do that, you know, listen to them. That's their job, is to hold you accountable. And they may have to hold you accountable for what you've said or posted online. You know, there's just some things that I, as a Christian, I'm not going to like if you post it online. You post a picture of you in your bikini online, I'm not going to like it. I'm probably going to have to feel like I should come talk to you about it. You shouldn't have posted that. You post a picture of you in a bar with a Bud Light sign behind you with a beer in your hand, I'm probably going to be calling you the next day. See, you shouldn't have posted that. You post something with cuss words in it, taking the Lord's name in vain, then if I see that, I'm going to feel like I need to go talk to brother or sister so-and-so about that. And I'm just trying to hold you accountable, just like I would expect you to hold me accountable if you saw something that was questionable or risque or rude or disrespectful. And that's what we do as brothers and sisters, not because we don't like each other or trying to hurt each other's feelings, but because we want the best for that person and their reputation and their influence, and we don't want to bring, we don't want anybody to blaspheme the church because of how we're behaving in a hypocritical way or a way that could be interpreted that way. So be careful with what you say and how you say things, and let people hold you accountable. And then develop flesh and blood friendships. Oh, man. Don't let all your friends be people who are digital friends. Talk to some real flesh and blood people sometimes who will be good for you in your life. We all need that.